Coming up on Path to Zero.
You're concerned about climate change and designing a house that can withstand a natural disaster. You know, it's up to you pretty much to do the research to figure out how to safeguard your house.
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, engineer, entrepreneur, business leader, speaker, and clean energy industry veteran, who now serves as president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Hello again, Path to Zero listeners. Resilient home design is the subject of this episode because homes and the energy we use to heat them, cook in them, take warm baths and showers in them are as much a part of the climate change conversation as transportation or big industry. It's also a good topic because extreme weather events that used to happen only once in 100 years now seem to happen with much more frequency, and the scientific community has pointed to climate change caused specifically by greenhouse gas emissions as one of the big reasons why this happens. And the data bears this out. In a severe weather trend study we recently published at the Propane Education and Research Council, we noted that over the past four decades, extreme weather events in the U.S. have increased on average 4.4% each year. More than 300 weather events, each of which caused over $1 billion in damage, have hit the U.S. since 1980. All of that is why I'm very pleased to have author Boyce Thompson as our guest today. His latest book, Designing for Disaster, details methods for building homes to withstand the growing threat of hurricanes, fires, floods, shifting earth, and tornadoes. Several homes featured in the book actually survived major natural disasters, including the Great Northern California fires, hurricanes like Hurricane Irma, and the Category 5 tornado that struck Joplin, Missouri. Thompson spent more than 30 years covering the housing market, including 17 as the editorial director of Builder Magazine. Boyce, it is a pleasure to welcome you to Path to Zero. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks a lot, Tucker. Appreciate it.
You know, we're going to talk a lot about your book, Designing for Disaster, but talk to us about what inspired you to even write that book and perhaps where you were trying to inform when you wrote it.
Well, it was an interesting odyssey. When the idea was first hatched, I had a pretty good idea of how to build a house to defend it against a natural disaster, you know, a flood, a hurricane, a tornado, an earthquake. We'd covered plenty of those topics in Builder Magazine, and I'd covered them in previous books that I'd written, but I hadn't done a lot of the basic research on climate change and the incidence of natural disasters, and that was a huge wake-up call for me. And kind of what I learned was that homeowners, my book is written for homeowners rather than home builders, so I suppose builders, architects, engineers, they're all going to gain something from the information. But I found that it's pretty much the Wild West out there for a homeowner. You know, if you read the New York Times and you're concerned about, you know, climate change and designing a house that could withstand a natural disaster, and if you really believe this stuff and you're building in an area where you know that there's been a disaster before, whether it's a hurricane, a tornado, or, you know, just severe weather, fires too, well, geez, and you know, it's up to you pretty much to do the research to figure out how to safeguard your house.
And what is it that a homeowner can do in those kind of situations? Is that done always as they think about new construction, or are there some things they can do even post-construction?
Well, my book primarily focuses on what you could do before you build the house. I mean, there are some pretty widely published kind of methods for protecting a house once it's already built. But what I found interesting was that, you know, in a lot of places, you're not dealing with modern building codes. You know, there was a FEMA study that came out a couple years ago. I don't know if you saw this. It's like 65% of counties, cities, towns haven't adopted modern building codes. So we know how that process works. There's an international building code. It's a model code that's published, and then it's up to the local government to decide whether to adopt it. And communities are slow to adopt it. Sometimes builders, other financial interests will kind of prevent a city from adopting a code provision that's going to raise the cost of new houses. So that's one problem. And then I couldn't believe this statistic, but 30% of communities in the United States, they have codes that are at least 20 years old, or maybe they don't even have building codes. And that really struck me as that was a real wake up call for me. So I think that the burden is on homeowners, selecting a real good architect, a real conscientious builder, and then going out and figuring out what they need to include in the house so that it's safe. And they can take advantage of the International Building Code. You could go read the model building code and see what it calls for in terms of fire protection or, shear walls and things of that nature. But you can also depend on these great voluntary industry standards. The insurers publish a great voluntary code for hurricane-prone regions, and the firefighters have one for, building homes near national forests, pardon me. So it's kind of, the burden is in it. And then these days, I think if you know that you're building in an area where there could be an earthquake, or you could have really strong lateral winds, or, just really big storms, it's probably a good idea to hire a structural engineer to kind of go over the builder's plan and figure out whether there aren't easy ways to build a house that will stand for a longer time.
I know one of the things I learned in studying your book, and I'd never thought about it before, but as you just mentioned, that so many of the codes lag for whatever reason. And you really make the point that I think the homeowner has to take the ownership. You really can't rely on your architect or your engineer or your local code officials. That the homeowners need to take the initiative to see that they're forward looking rather than building to this, I would say, outdated standard. In the book, you also showcase a lot of successes, homes that survived some pretty horrific things. Would you share some of those lessons with the listeners, please?
Well, yeah, I think there's some pretty encouraging stories in the book. Several of the projects were undertaken by homeowners who'd lost a house to fire or to a hurricane or to a tornado in one case. And so they were really concerned in building a new one that, they take appropriate measures. And there's one house, it wasn't actually in my book, but it's one that people know about. It's called the Sandcastle House. And it was directly in the path of Hurricane Michael. That was the Category 5 hurricane that hit the Gulf Coast in 2018. Remember that one? Yeah, and it was one house, like amid all the rubble, that remained standing. And they showed its picture on CNN. I think it made it into the Times and other national building codes or other national media. But the moral of that story was in that part of the Florida, you only had to build a house to withstand a 120 mile per hour wind. But the Sandcastle House was built to withstand winds twice as strong. So it was built on pilings that were dug deep into the ground. Pardon me. The main living areas of the house were raised 10 feet so that a storm surge could pass underneath. And that's like a best practice. And you needed to figure out what the path of a 100-year storm would be. And you need to make sure that your house is above that level. In some areas of New York and New Jersey where Sandy hit, people along the coast are building 12 and 13 feet higher than what the local codes require. So, and then the walls, and this is a trade-off, but the walls of that house were built with concrete, reinforced with steel rebar. So those aren't the most environmentally benign products on the earth, but they provide a much stronger, house. So you've got it. That's one trade-off that you have to make. And then the window openings were limited, but they used hurricane resistant windows, right? So, you and I both know that there's a cost upgrade to doing hurricane resistant windows, but maybe if you decrease the size of them, then, you know, you can offset some of that cost increase. And also, if you look at the house and look it up, it's like rented an Airbnb. It's called the Sandcastle House, but it's got really limited eaves, which, so you don't get the roof isn't going to be under pressure and high winds to flip off the house. But the result is the house maybe doesn't look as attractive as it could. So that's one of the trade-offs that I talk about in the book. You know, like a lot of people may be building near the ocean or near a beautiful a national forest. Then they want windows, right? They need to be able to enjoy these views. But the case of a hurricane, the windows are the weakest link. You know, once air and water get inside the house, they can create a pressurized situation where the roof gets blown off. So you got to be really careful about that. And same is true with fire. I can't remember all the statistics on that, but you definitely want to invest in tempered glass that's going to do a better job of resisting an encroaching fire. I got a story about fire, too, that I could tell. Unless you want to talk about something else.
No, go ahead, please.
But, the fire thing, a lot of this was new to me. I mean, I live in the Mid-Atlantic where fire isn't a big threat. But my God, can you imagine building a new home out in Northern California today? All the concern you'd have? Because in some cases, these forest fires are leaping from forested areas into suburban subdivisions. They're like crossing highways and just, wiping out entire communities. It's really a scary time. And there's something called the Wildland Urban Interface Code that a lot of communities use to protect homes against fires. And it's been fairly effective, though not completely effective. And the problem is that, a lot of people, you want to buy a house and kind of the mountains near the woods, and people are buying more second homes than they ever used to, and humans cause about 80% of the forest fires in the United States. So the fact that people are moving into these areas makes everybody more liable for fire. So it's interesting, the one house profiled in the book was in the path of the Norobam fire. That was a part of a system of 21 Northern California wildfires in 2017. These fires burn an area the size of Indiana. It's like incredible to think about, wow. And this particular home survived. And the interesting thing about it was built with straw bale. But, as you probably know, straw bale is covered with plaster. And so when fire approached from the yard, it hit a plaster wall and didn't penetrate the house. And the architect and the homeowner together took precautions to make sure that wherever fire might encroach, it was going to encounter metal, concrete, or plaster, as opposed to wood. Now, there was still some wood on the house, but it was thicker wood that would take fire longer to burn through. It was typically redwood or cedar, which is natural resistance to fire. And then the roof was a metal roof. I guess there's a reason why metal roofs are growing in popularity, but if embers had hit the top of that roof, they could just fly over and the house wouldn't catch fire. Then the house also had something called a defensible perimeter. And if you were building a home in one of these areas today, you'd want to look that up. It's a pretty interesting standard. It basically dictates what you want to plant or have around the 100 feet of your house, so basically right around the house, you don't want to have things that can burn quickly. You want those things farther away from the house. And then the house itself, to the extent that you can build with, concrete, steel, thicker wood, or maybe protect wood with gypsum so that it takes much longer for fire to burn through, you're better off. So there's a whole art to that. Creating a defensible perimeter that's really kind of fascinating. And there's some evidence that it works.
You talk so much about homeowners, but do you feel like architects, generally architects, but more so than engineers or even contractors, are architects waking up to the need for this, in your opinion?
I think that architects you know, I think architects by and large are more environmentally conscious than home builders, but I don't, you know, and probably a lot more of them are waking up, but it's also a business opportunity for them because, you know, odds are if you go out and buy a production house from a national builder, it's not going to have all the safeguards that you would want. So if you're fortunate enough to be able to hire an architect and build your own house, you're probably in a better position to design in safeguards. I mean, that's the bottom line, because you and I both know that most national production builders are going to build to the code. And if the problem is that the code is inadequate, well, you know, then the house maybe isn't going to provide the protection that you might want. So I think in the case, if you're really interested in a resilient house, you're better off with going with somebody local, you know, even if there is an added cost, because that local person's going to have a better idea of what the environmental challenges are locally. That local person probably would have a better network of engineers, soil engineers, structural engineers that they could call in. And, you know, the bottom line in a lot of this stuff is if you do it in the beginning, it doesn't cost a lot more. Right. And, you know, you can build a house that's way more protected. Like, I visited parts of the country as part of writing the book. I visited parts of the country that have been hit hard by tornadoes. So I went down to Moore, Oklahoma, which has been just devastated by major tornadoes in the last 15 years. And they put a new building code in place. And initially, there was a lot of, you know, negative response to it. The builders were concerned about raising the cost, but then somebody figured out, a structural engineer as a consultant, that it would really only raise the cost by, you know, on a typical home by maybe $3,000, $3,500. So we're talking about basically putting anchors, you know, doing a shear wall so the walls of the house aren't as liable to move if wind hits them sideways, but also tying the roof to the walls and tying the foundation to the walls and all those good things. So it's just a matter of using more tie downs and anchor bolts and all these good products. And $3,500, wow, you could save, maybe you don't finish your basement, or maybe you just, you know, downgrade your kitchen specs and you've saved all the money you need to in order to provide a house that's gonna last longer. So they're also, that's one of the trade-offs that I discuss in the book. Anyway, I'm veering a little bit away from your question, but, you know, hiring local people is a good idea, because one of the things I learned is that where natural disasters have struck before, they're likely to strike again and with increased regularity. That's the sad fact of the matter.
Yeah, one of the things I've noticed, we don't have very many tornadoes, but the ones we have in our geography almost always appear within literally 3 or 4 miles of that path. So that certainly seems to be true. You talk a lot about power outages. You know, something we used to think about just in California around wildfire threat, but certainly now, you know, ice storms in the Northeast, tornadoes all through the Midwest, hurricanes through the South and Southeast. Well, how do you advise homeowners to be ready for these extended power outages?
Yeah, well, you know, it's something called resilience, right? So that's the lofty term for it. And I cover it in the book, because part of building a house to withstand a natural disaster is building a house that can function independent of the utility grid. And I think it starts these days with building the most energy efficient home possible so that you can put on the most cost-effective photovoltaic system. And, you know, virtually every custom home these days is designed to be photovoltaic ready. So that overcomes problems with, if you're disconnected from the utility grid, at least in terms of electricity. But then the next thing you need to consider is, you know, all the free sources of energy that are out there. And that's strange. All these ideas have come back, you know, in vogue, just like my father's old ties. So you see houses built with a, you know, natural ventilation, fireplaces that actually work, and overhangs that protect the house from overheating in the summer, and, you know, but still allow warmth to enter the house during the winter. And then, You know, you see more and more houses built with backup power generation, which is something that, you know, if you have the money, I think makes a lot of sense to do. If you live building in an area where utilities are prone to go out, I'm not sure why you wouldn't do this if you had the money to do it, of course. One caveat to that would be if you were to put, you know, say propane tanks in the yard, you need to make sure that they're, you know, they're above the floodplain if your house is vulnerable to that sort of activity. And of course, there are other safeguards that you know better about than I do, but it's something that probably makes sense to consider.
Yeah, certainly above the floodplain if you're worried about that, and below the ground if you're worried about fire, for sure. Boyce, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll pick up the conversation right after this.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a zero emissions future starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low-carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people, with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane, energy for everyone. Learn more at propane.com. Maybe I'll win.
Our guest today is Boyce Thompson, a long career with Builder Magazine and the author of three books, but the one we're talking about today is Designing for Disaster. Welcome back. You know, you've mentioned a couple times about data. You've seen this data around storms, the increasing severity of weather. How do you think your own perspective may have changed before you saw this data and now after you've learned more about these trends in severe weather? I mean, what did you believe then and maybe that you don't do now or vice versa? How has that data really informed you differently?
Well, you know, I did a lot of the basic research and I found that you can't really, you know, argue that every natural disaster is due to global warming. You can definitely tie you know, the growing incidence of hurricanes and tornadoes and forest fires to global warming, but some of the other, you know, less frequent events, it's harder to do. So that was kind of interesting. But, you know, the data shows that like all these natural disasters are increasing in frequency. So you got to wonder why. And the other piece of data that was disturbing is the evidence that, you know, global warming is pretty much baked in. And we're all paying kind of for the sins of our fathers or whatever. And there's not a whole lot that an individual can do to make a dent. At one individual, even a developer can do to make a dent in global warming. So one of the morals of the book is that we need to be thinking offense and defense, right? You need to be thinking defense in terms of how do you protect your house from a natural disaster. But then you need to be thinking offense. Even though the evidence is that any individual, one individual can't have a big impact, you still need to be doing your best to reduce global carbon emissions because some of the data on buildings is amazing. I need to look it up real quick, but I think it's, yeah, buildings generate nearly 40% of annual global CO2 emissions. Of course, 28% of that goes to building operations, but 11% to new construction. So, you know, one of the morals of my story is that, you know, building a new home is not a great event for the environment, but to the extent that you could build a home that would last forever or that would last for several generations, you're doing the world, you know, a real favor because, you know, it's less likely that somebody come in, tear the house down and rebuild it.
Right.
Aesthetics are part of that too. The house needs to look good.
Yeah, that's right. And I love the all through your book that you really make the point to say you can do these things without suffering for aesthetics, that aesthetics can still be maintained, but have, you know, basically a disaster-proof building. Like I follow you through Builder Magazine, have for a long time, and I know you, although you are a great writer, you're also a bit of a technologist, right? You have really dedicated a lot of your career to studying new technologies, and you were always the voice about telling us what new technologies are coming out and really how to think about including them. As you look to the future now, what are some of the technologies out there that excite you, that, you know, really benefit homeowners, whether it be for efficiency or for comfort or for the environment? Anything come to mind?
You know, for 5 years, I took an exhibit of what I called life-changing products to home shows around the country. And I tried to demonstrate the latest smart home products and green products. And I'd actually set them up so people could use them. So they, you know, people put on virtual reality headsets, and they'd walk through a model home that hadn't been built, and they could change the options and see what, you know, a kitchen with birch cabinetry might look like, or, you know, add a third bedroom instead of a garage bay, do things like that. And people found that was weird. You know, maybe I could only get maybe a quarter of the people who came through the exhibit to put on the headphones. But once they did, it was like an eye-opening experience. So if I were a builder or an architect today, I would definitely be looking at that, because it's a way to save money. You know, you don't have to model a house, and people can see in unbelievable clarity exactly what kind of home they'd be getting. So I was really impressed with that. But then a lot of these smart home tools, you know, like voice activated systems, and they cost so little, and they produce a pretty solid lifestyle benefit. To be able to see who's at your door before you open it, to be able to, like, you know, I run the risk of addressing Alexa or Google, because they'll probably respond as we're talking. But, you know, there's all this cool stuff you can do throughout the house to just make it a much more convenient place to live. And then these, I think one of the no-brainers, I can't imagine you'd buy a new house that wouldn't have one these days, would be, you know, one of these programmable thermostats that automatically knows when you're not around and turns itself down. That stuff is just amazing, and it's been proven to save people money. So a lot of good stuff out there today. I would encourage, you know, if you are a builder, to look at all this stuff and find a way to create packages so that you can offer it to people, because they're going to do it after the fact, and you might as well make sure that the home can accommodate it when you build it.
It's one of the things, it's funny, I attend the energy conferences, climate conferences, almost on a regular basis around the country and often around the world. And the word conservation is almost never used, right? I mean, and I think it's the basic element of getting to a better climate, using less water, using less land, using less energy. And you can do that so easily through your choice of lighting, your choice of furnace, your choice of thermostat, as you kind of say. So I knew you'd have an opinion on it. I think for me, I'm encouraged now for the first time. I believe gas heat pumps are, you know, ready for use. And then what we're doing with combined heating and power, and then adding a cooling leg. So now for this, you know, you got, I don't know, 4 or 5 kilowatts of power at your disposal. You got waste heat, and you got a very efficient furnace. So for us, gas heat pumps, and then CHP units with a cooling leg are, I think we're starting to see them move into these high electric cost areas with great success. What, do you have any other thoughts you want to share about clean energy sources and maybe how that's changing the home building environment, or any tips you want to give about energy independence? And certainly something top of mind for everybody today. Any thoughts you have on that for consumers as they think about new homes?
Well, you know, you and I both know that a home is only conserves as much energy as the builder wants it to conserve. You know, a lot of that is just pure effort. And it's, you know, reminding trade contractors of the importance to eliminate air gaps. You know, it's like doing the thermal imaging tests and, you know, really caring about things like that, and testing, you know, doing blower door tests. If I were a consumer today buying a house, I'd insist that it would at least be built to the Energy Star standards. And those are pretty, those are pretty stringent now. They're kind of above market. So, you know, that's a good remedy. But, you know, the reality is that a lot of the stuff that that produces an energy-conserving house doesn't have to cost much more money. It's just a matter of effort. So, you know, I'd advise everybody to make sure they make that effort, because we, you know, we owe it to the environment to do that.
And as you think about your book, maybe even your career, what's the call to action you have for homeowners and builders and architects and maybe even code officials? What's the call to action?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I think we all have a responsibility to build in the most responsible manner we can. And because, you know, building a home is still a negative event for the environment. So I think it really makes sense to do all the research you can do. I mean, my hat's off to you to investigating these alternative power systems, because, you know, that's a big concern. I remember I built a demonstration home almost 30 years ago where I used kind of optimal value engineering to kind of rethink the framing system and took a like 15-20% of the lumber out of a house and then use it to buy a much way more energy efficient heating HVAC system. So there's just a lot you can do in terms of value engineering a house in order to spend money on the things that really matter today and in the future.
Yeah, well said. Boys, we have some fun on this podcast, and one of the things we do is we use a magic wand, and that magic wand has very few rules, but a few. You can use it to change one thing, so just one thing. It's time dependent. It has to be in the next year, and it's around the climate. But I'm going to hand you the magic wand and ask you, what would you like to see done differently? Perhaps how would you wave that wand to make a change that will dramatically improve our ability to move towards a better climate, a more resilient future for consumers?
In terms of moving toward a better climate, I mean, I think we all need to do everything we can to reduce our carbon consumption. So if we're building a new home, it needs to be as energy efficient as possible. And then you need to really investigate all the green products that are out there. I remember 20 years ago writing about the introduction of new green products, and there was always a cost uptick if you wanted to use them. And a lot of the reliability of these products was improving. But today, my God, it's a no-brainer. There's so much research that has been done. There are all these voluntary standards out there that kind of that weigh in and can tell you just exactly how products are made and how much energy they're going to consume. So I would apply a green filter to like any building product that I bought today, really kind of research it and figure out whether I'm making the best decision possible. Then the other thing that clearly needs to happen is that the local governments need to update their building codes. So, you know, even when they adopt the most recent building code from the International Code Body, they may not, you know, include provisions that would work to the benefit of people building homes in a community. And, you know, it's a tough call to make in many cases, but it's one that needs to be made. And the other thing to think about is, you know, flooding is the biggest risk. If you look at all the environmental risks, flooding is number one. And the problem is that, FEMA, which keeps the maps of communities that are at risk of 100-year floods, you know, they woefully undercount the number of communities that are at risk. There's some private studies out there that have, you know, said it's about 75% higher if you consider, different kinds of floods and floods from smaller streams and whatnot. So I'd be real careful about building, you know, anywhere near an area that is flooded before. But then, people need to think about whether their community wants to be on this list of communities that are susceptible to 100-year floods, which seem to be occurring with, you know, more and more regularity. You know, a lot of times there's resistance to having the community on the flood map because people fear it's going to, negatively influence their property values. So anyway, that needs to be, you need to think long and hard about that, because imagine somebody moving into a community, buying a new house that's actually susceptible to flooding, and then they're not even aware of it.
You lead me into being forced to ask you one more question, and that is green building, so building with the earth and climate in mind, is that in conflict or complementary to building with resilience and disaster in mind?
There are some conflicts, you know, like concrete construction, you know, environmentally, it's not the best thing in the world, but it's overtaking Florida, you know, which isn't a bad thing, but it's one way to protect against hurricanes. It's a major way to protect against hurricanes. I remember 15 years ago, used to just see concrete blocks used in southern Florida. Now the whole state, they've become the norm. And it's people worried about, you know, their house being blown over by strong winds. So that's, you know, there's a trade-off there.
Interesting.
There are others too. Steel is another one. Too many of the houses in my book were built with steel reinforcement. You know, if you're a great architect, you know what you can do when you have, you know, steel beams in a house. It's just like, it's amazing what you can do in terms of creating impressions of tremendous spaces. And so there's too many great custom homes are built with steel, and that's a negative environmental event.
Thank you for that. Look, you've been a great guest. I know, I love your perspectives. We also, the last thing we do that's fun is we thank you for your time and for your expertise by planting a tree in the National Forest. We call it the virtual National Forest, or I like to call it the propane National Forest. But I know you live outside of Washington. I think you're a Marylander, right? Isn't that correct?
That is true.
So would you be willing, if we thought about planting a tree in your name, in George Washington's National Forest or the Jefferson National Forest, one of those appeal to you, perhaps?
Yeah, George Washington sounds great. You know, I'm on this genealogy kick, though, and I figured out I'm related to Peter Wright, who lived in West Virginia back in the 1780s. And there's a whole mountain range named after him, Peter's Mountain. So if you could find a way to plant me a tree there, that would be great. Otherwise, I'll settle for George Washington.
Is Peter's Mountain near Petersburg?
No, okay. It's out. Geez, I couldn't even tell you what it's near. I went out there one time. It was in the middle of nowhere.
Well, I want to give you a chance to kind of tell our listeners how to learn more about you, and maybe more importantly, about your books. Where would you have them go to learn more about your three books?
Well, you know, I work with a great publisher, Schiffer Publishing, and they get my book into all the architectural bookstores. So if you've got one of those in your city or town, then I recommend going there. Also, the great independent bookstores tend to carry my books, but all of them are available on Amazon, you know, Barnes & Noble, all the online portals. So, you know, and I got a couple coming up. I've got a book coming out later this year called The Forever Home, where I'm kind of building on what I reported on in Designing for Disaster. And the notion there is I interviewed 60 people during the pandemic to ask them kind of, you know, how they related to their house, how their house worked for them, with the idea of kind of getting best practices that architects could use to design houses that might people might want to live in forever. So it'd be interesting to see how that does. And anyway, and I have a website too, boycethompson.com.
Well, Boyce, you've been a great guest. Love hearing your perspective. So thank you for spending some time with us today.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks, Tucker.
To all our listeners, that wraps up this episode. And a quick reminder, if you want to send a note to comment on an episode or give us a new topic to consider, just shoot me an email at pathtozero@propane.com. That's path, the word T-O, pathtozero@propane.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn. Hope to hear from you, and I look forward to hearing from you. Thanks for listening. See you next time on Path to Zero.
Thank you for listening to Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to pathtozero@propane.com.